Okay, hello everybody, and welcome back to the Applied Human Design podcast. My name is Heather, and as always, I'm so happy that you are here spending a little bit of time with me today. So, today is going to be a fun one. You know what I say, they are all fun, but today's especially fun because we're kind of trying out, well, not exactly, but kind of, we're trying out like a new format to the podcast, right? You know, we typically have like no structure. Usually I just chat a bit and then go straight into whatever I'm talking about, whatever. But since, well, if you've listened to the last episode, last week's episode, you know, I've not been too well. I've been a bit sick. I am a bit sick, and I've not really had the energy to go explore Serbia and like just do usual touristy slash history nerd things that I would typically love to do. I have been, in fact, in bed a lot. I've watched 2 seasons of Modern Family so far, and I'm almost up to the part in Modern Family where I kind of like stopped watching when I watched it the first time. Obviously, it's like a weird show, but for whatever reason, it's really, really comforting, and I feel like it's curing me from whatever I have right now. You know, I'm sure that's what I'll tell my doctor when I go back to Australia. I don't need to. I have Disney Plus. Anyway, so, wow, we're already off on a tangent. But what it has meant that I was like, okay, well, I'm in a new country. I still want to learn about this country. And so I have been, just like doing Google, just good old Google searches of the history. And obviously I always like to learn about folklore and any like superstition and magical practices of wherever I go, because witch things. So all that to say, what I've decided that we're going to have at the start of every podcast from now on is fun facts with Heather. These will just be like however many fun facts that I have learned and found interesting throughout my week that I think you guys either will or won't find interesting as well. They will be completely random, nothing that you can ever use in useful conversation. But, you know, I think that it's a really good way for us to almost like, even if, you know, we're not traveling right now, and even if I am about to go and stay in one place for at least like 4, 5, 6 months, whatever, to let my body heal, we can still go around the world and learn about all different cultures and practices and all that using our minds. So let's start there. So obviously we'll do that, we'll chat, and then we will go into the main topic for today, which, if you had not guessed from the title, is going to be kind of talking about some of the esoteric roots of human design. So this is something that, yeah, I think, well, I've never spoken about, not in any depth anyway. And also just like doing the research. Well, this episode was really, really interesting for me. It also tickled my brain, which really enjoys learning. So, first fun facts. Okay, so where to start? Should we start with, hang on, let me find my notes. Okay, so the note that I had written was Jewish soul trap and evil eye on babies, but these correspond to the two fun facts that we're going to chat about. Anyway, so now that I've figured out exactly what my notes referred to. Okay, so the first one, the Jewish soul trap. So since we're going to talk about, obviously since we're going to be speaking about some of the esoteric roots of human design, we will be speaking about Kabbalistic practices today. And I learned this fun fact. Well, it's not, I guess you wouldn't exactly say it's fun. But I learned this fact when I was reading. So I've, now that I have been in bed so much for the last week or so, I mean, you'll be able to hear, you can probably hear the difference in my voice between last week and this week. I'm feeling much more alive. So thank you so much all again for the love and good blessings and just listening. You know, in general, I feel your vibes, even if you are not someone who chats to me, whatever, I know you're there. Anyway, so I've been finally getting around to properly reading Protection Magic by Jason Miller, which has been on my to-be-read pile for so, so long. And I've sort of like browsed through it, but not, and just like kind of played with some rituals and stuff, but not actually read it cover to cover, which is what I'm doing right now. So I learned this fact in this book that back in, I want to say it was like 2004 or 2005, a bunch of extremists are in Israel got together and performed an ancient Kabbalistic death curse called the Pulsa Denora, or Lash of Fire is like the translation. And this particular prime minister, a few months later, I think it was like 3 months later, basically almost like his health conditions worsened so much that he eventually went into a vegetative state. And he didn't actually die for another, I don't know, 10 years or something. Maybe not that long, but a while. But yeah. And then another interesting part of that was there was also another Israeli prime minister was also had the exact same curse put on him, or a similar curse. I'm not sure if it was the Lash of Fire, but a similar one by practitioners a month before he was assassinated in 1995. So yeah, I just thought that was super interesting. Obviously sucks for these people. I don't know anything about their politics. I haven't looked into that. But yeah, a lot in this book is about like identifying when someone has put a curse on you, which, you know, obviously none of you probably need to worry about. That being said, I have had to remove an ancestral curse off a client before. But you know, again, like he said, like Jason Miller says in this book, like the chances are so, so slim. But anyway, so he talks about like just cursing being a part of so many different practices across history, which is actually also a really good lead in to my Serbian folk magic and superstition in Serbia and folk wisdom sort of facts. So I am just going to read you a few interesting like Serbian superstitions that I came up with. So you will know the evil eye. So the evil eye, it's not just from Greek tradition, it's not just from Greek folk magic, it's also found in Italian folk magic and basically all over the Mediterranean, and obviously it's found its way into Serbia as well. So it might be from, it might be found all over the Balkans as well, and different versions of the evil eye that found in most folk practices around the world. But let's read a few little fun facts. So you guys can also feel free to let me know like any superstitions from either your family or your tradition or your culture that you find super, super interesting. I was thinking about one that I was raised with the other day and I was like, that is so random. Where does that come from? I mean, a big one in my family was always like, oh, and this was just my parents, I guess, trying to make us kids never frown, but they were like, the wind will change when your face is like that and you'll be stuck that way. And oh my goodness, did I believe it. Another thing I believed is that for so long, probably till I was 10, I still doubted as to whether my parents really did have eyes in the back of their head and saw everything. I was thinking about that yesterday. But yeah, so let me know if you have some really interesting or even not interesting, and maybe I'll share your fun facts. Anyway, so Serbian superstition. Firstly, there are no baby showers held in Serbia. I love this one, right? There are no baby showers. There are no gifts given to the mother. And then when the baby is born, friends and family will call it ugly. Like, we'll call the baby ugly. Because it is believed that, you know, if they call it cute, if they admire the baby, if they make a big deal out of the child, then the baby will be vulnerable to the evil eye. So if you don't know what the evil eye is, essentially it is, and you know, it, anyone can give this to you essentially, but it's going to be when people look at you with the eyes of jealousy. So how many people, and like, it's weird because you're like, who would be jealous of a baby? But I mean, either they're going to be jealous of like the fact that this mother had such a cute baby, like if they call the baby cute, or they're just jealous of, you know, a child and its life force and its aliveness and it's got its whole life ahead of it, right? Like, you could also see it like that. And obviously a baby doesn't have like a ton of protection, and well, I guess I'm gonna go ahead and guess like the mother, if they believe in this, will have like little amulets and stuff around the child as well. But yeah, so that's really interesting. So to protect from evil eye, you're going to have like your amulets, like you would know the like that you can buy ever in Greece. Like, my friend who I was traveling with in Athens, she's like, that thing creeps me out so much. You go into any store and there's just like all these little eyes looking at you. But that's the point, right? But you can protect from it in other ways. And you can also, like, if you do have evil eye on you, there are different ways to remove it. I have successfully done evil eye removal for myself before. And yeah, there are other different, like, I guess based on the fog practice that you work with. But so I thought that was a fun fact. Let's read a couple more superstitions. So women wishing to get married in Serbia are cautioned against sitting at the corner of the table at mealtimes. I don't know exactly what this means. I don't know if they mean like hard, like the hard corner, or just being towards a corner, because that would be difficult. Because what if you're at a table of four? Like, aren't they all corners? Are we single ladies just supposed to eat on the floor? Like, is that the plan? I'm gonna need more information there. So if anybody knows, let me know. Okay, when someone is traveling, a person back home cannot wash their clothing that was left behind. If they do, the traveler will never come back. So we're just not going to ask any of my family members as to whether they've washed any items of my clothing while I've been away, because I don't want to know, right? I plan on coming back. That one would be a little bit difficult too, because my sister borrows my clothes. I've seen pictures of her, like, since she's been home wearing my clothes. So, assuming she's washed them, but she's just washing them as hers. Okay, if an unwanted visitor comes to the house, the Serbian folklore requires that the homeowner wash the floor after they visit so that they will not come back. Yeah, I've seen this in other folklore practices as well. I was learning about English folk magic at the time. And you can actually make a specific floor wash that has a lot of herbs and stuff that has the intention of basically do not come back. Like, you are not welcome back. So we love that. Okay. Women who expose their stomachs to a cold draft will obtain frozen ovaries and are never able to fall pregnant. That sucks, because, you know, I love a crop top. So, but then again, maybe it's good because I don't really want kids. So we love that. I don't know if this one is found elsewhere in other types of folklore, but whistling while in the house will entice mice to enter. So be warned, you whistlers. I don't know. I'm not really a whistler, so I can't really speak to personal experience, but I have had a mouse in my house a couple of times. And I can't remember. Obviously, this was like years ago, so I can't remember if I was whistling at the time. But if anybody wants to experiment, I'd be curious. And I like this one too, and I've been thinking about this one. Opening two windows in a room or residence, especially if to create cross ventilation during a hot day, brings in evil spirits with the created breeze. So I guess that's like, yeah, if you open windows on opposite sides of the house, which is so nice, like when it's a hot day and then you get the cool change and then you just have the wind blowing in from either side. But, you know, if there's evil spirits coming in with that, I don't want a bar of it. Right, so that's been fun facts with Heather. We spoke about the Jewish soul trap. We spoke about the baby thing. And like I said, feel free to send me through on Instagram or whatever your fun facts, your like folk magic, your family folk magic, your family superstitions. I'm fascinated. I do not get to go outside a lot recently, again, because I've been sick, so fill my brain with interesting things. Alrighty, so the last little thing before we get into the main discussion for today is just, you know, catching up with me. I basically have already told you I feel more alive. I feel like I've got my personality back. I have been eating a lot of fruit and vegetables. You know, if you follow me on Instagram, you get to watch my daily bowls of apples. All the hottest content, you know, always the hottest content. Here's today's bowl of apples. Anyway, so that's been happening. And then, like I said, I've also just been resting hardcore and really, really working on. So I was voice noting with my middle sister today and just sort of reflecting on how in our family, don't know if I spoke about this last week. I don't think I did. You'll have to, if I'm repeating things, it is because I was literally on death's door when I recorded last week. So whatever. But yeah, in my family, it was kind of like, okay, so if you were sick, like let's say you were home from school because you were sick. If you showed any kind of like smiling or laughing or personality or like hint of your old self, like from before you were sick, my parents would be like, oh, well, you're smiling. I guess you can go to school, essentially. And this is something that I am really, really focusing on removing from my system. Like this is something that has been really, really present. and so, yeah, just noticing that feeling come up, like, obviously I don't go to school, but just it coming up and me being like, oh, you know, I am feeling better today. Like I don't have the same amount of brain fog that I did last week. I can just think so much more clearer than I could last week. And so of course my conditioned nervous system is like, well, then you should be working. Like you should be like putting this energy into doing new projects and, you know, like just launching stuff and making money and all of that stuff. And I'm really, really focusing on just being like, no, like that is not true. Like just because I have the slightest hint of my personality back doesn't mean that I immediately need to give that to others. And this has been a big theme of, I think this, what, let's say this Venus retrograde for just like womankind as a whole, like a lot of both clients, friends that I've spoken to, is this just realization that essentially as women, we've been conditioned to believe that our worth lies in how much we do for others. Our worth lies in giving to everyone but ourselves. And that is completely not true. And yeah, just really reminding myself that I can keep these chunks of energy for myself. Like I can almost like be greedy with my energy in this sense. And that's okay. Okay. So another thing that I wanted to speak about, it's kind of just going to be a bit of a hodgepodge today. Hey, but we will get into the, esoteric stuff in a second, but, I don't think we'll speak for too long on that. We'll see. Anyway, should only take like 20 minutes or something. But anyway, so I know I wanted to speak about the Barbie movie, and you know I really wanted to speak about it last week when it was a bit more like culturally centered. I feel like it's not like we've moved on, we're still so there. I'm pretty sure I'm planning on seeing it again once I get home. I think I want to go by myself. Like I saw it with my best friend and that was great, but I feel like I just take in movies a lot better when I'm not with someone else as well. So yeah, I wanted to speak on this and just the fact that it came out on Venus retrograde, and there are so many amazing astrologers talking about the significance of this and just the way that this movie so deeply explores a lot of the, I think, things that are coming to the surface for a lot of women especially, but also just the world as a whole as we move through this Venus retrograde. And yeah, there was one scene in particular that really, really impacted me and made me think of my Aphrodite shadow episode that I did a couple of weeks ago, probably a few weeks ago now. And that was, yeah, this, I mean, obviously there are a few scenes that hit me really hard. Like if you haven't seen it, please go see it. Just do yourself a favor. But the scene that really, really hit me was when Barbie and Ken first leave Barbie World and like, spoilers, by the way. But I'm sure you know the general plot by now. It's all over the internet. But yeah, Barbie and Ken first leave Barbie World and they land in like the real world, right? And they are like rollerblading at, I think it's Venice Beach. It's somewhere in LA. I believe it's Venice. And, you know, all of a sudden Ken, being a dude, is feeling like admired. Like he's the man, right? Like people are looking up to him. And Barbie, for the first time in her life, because she comes from Barbie Land where women are respected and women are in positions of power and women are looked as people, right? Humans. And all of a sudden she's like objectified and people are like looking at her with these like predatory eyes and all of that. And that particular scene really, really hit me. And this is the reason why, right? Because there are so many people who will say that, well, it's two things, right? Firstly, there are people who say, well, obviously there are people who say like, feminism has done its work. Like, you know, we're cool. It's happened. And I think this movie, like this particular scene, and you know, I don't know what, well, obviously this is part of the point that Greta Gerwig, like the director, wanted to make, and Margot being the producer and star wanted to make, is that, okay, women might be in the workforce, right? And you know, even if you don't bring in the topics of like the wage gap and all of that, like, and everyone's like, you know, women can work, and so feminism's done what it's meant to do. They're like, your problems are solved. Okay, I would rather be able to walk down a busy street in the middle of the day and feel just as safe as a man does doing that than be able to work. I really would. To me, my fundamental physical safety is more important than the fact that I can like work in a boardroom. Obviously, under capitalism, that's not as important. But anybody who's saying that feminism has done its work, that, you know, we are completely equal, that women have nothing to complain about anymore, whatever rubbish, yeah, Uncle Misty Bum, definitely not an uncle's name. If you have an Uncle Misty Bum, please write me. I'll send you a prize. You know, whatever he's saying, right? What are women complaining about? You know, you had your movements, you got what you want, now you're just whinging. No, because yeah, again, we just want to feel safe walking down the street, as safe as you do. That's all I'm asking for. And then also it's like people commenting on the movie, and you know, fully understand their point by saying like, oh, you know, it's like very simple feminism, and it's like, okay, but so many people are not getting it. So many dudes have a problem with the fact that Barbie doesn't have kids, essentially, that obviously the culture needs a reminder. And so anyway, I really loved it. I think, oh yeah, and then just relating it back to the Aphrodite shadow thing, everything that I was speaking about women being objectified and viewed at essentially as a piece of meat, as a doll, right? Something that Barbie knows so, so well. And that's even without, you know, we can even have this discussion without even talking about the like America Ferrera monologue that moved everyone to tears. If you didn't cry, I don't know who you are. And just everything that speech in itself says around, yeah, these projections that women are living through day to day, that we're constantly trying to feel like we are, well, we're trying to prove that we have like earned, I guess, the rights that we've been given, the basic human rights we've been given, to try and prove that we're doing a good job, that we're doing it well. Everything, just read that monologue, go over it line by line with a fine-toothed comb, and you'll essentially have an entire Venus retrograde's worth of reflections around what it means to be a woman. So that's my thoughts on that. I've also seen lots of people on Instagram kind of comparing the Inanna myth to the Barbie movie. So the Inanna myth is something that is reflected in a lot of stories of women. And this, yeah, it's really, really fascinating, the reflections. And so the Inanna mythology is also really often linked with, connected to the Venus retrograde cycle. In that, you know, obviously at the moment, so at the time of recording, and probably when you're listening to this, unless you're listening to this, you know, in the future, hello, Venus is in the underworld. And so this is the point in the Venusian cycle where Venus gets so close to the sun that she is no longer visible. She goes under the beams of the sun, all up to the point to the exact conjunction of the sun, and then, you know, comes out the other side until eventually like separating from the sun enough that we can see her again, but she will be reborn, right? She goes into the underworld and becomes reborn as the opposite time of day star. So you know how you have Venus as the evening star and Venus as the morning star? So we've just had Venus as the evening star, and now Venus is in the underworld, but when she re-emerges, she will be the morning star, right? And so this is often compared to the Inanna mythology of Inanna having to, or feeling the call to go into the underworld. You know, she's queen. She's like living in her like lifestyle. Feels called to go into the underworld, is stripped away, stripped of all of her material possessions, essentially dies, right? And does find a way back up to the world, but then finds that her lover, her partner, has taken over, which is exactly what Ken does in the movie. And yeah, it's just so fascinating the way that the mythology lines up so perfectly with the movie. And that we can all, as women, really explore this mythology of, you know, what, and this is a question I'll give to you, right? And I will give to you is, what is the call into the underworld that you are feeling like during this Venus retrograde cycle? Like, what is the call inwards? And a personal underworld could be many different things, could look thousands of different ways. It could just be something that you have not wanted to admit about yourself. It's something that's been in the too hard basket for so long. It's something that you've wanted to look at. It's like, it doesn't have to be like, I guess, the typical idea of shadow work. It could be something completely, completely different. Like, so, you know, I've spoken a little bit on Instagram about my, and I think I even sent out an email about this as well, but my personal underworld experience right now is obviously coming through being sick. And it's not even, well, it is kind of to do with myself, but it's also to do with just seeing the culture and the conditioning in a new light. And just really completely reframing and taking this time to think about how I want to do this work, like do spiritual work in a world, in a culture, in conditioning that is not set up to help everyone, that is not set up to be a safe place for everyone. Again, read my email if you want my full point of view on this. And if you do want further thoughts on this, I could absolutely do a whole episode on this. But when we look, I think a lot of like modern spirituality, especially the spiritual industry, where we are selling ideas and lifestyles, if we want to put it that way, which is so crazy to say. How do I put this? We're selling concepts and ideas that are going to help people fit in with the dominant culture, which obviously for most of us, like for the world, is capitalism. And capitalism is a system that is never, I'm so sorry, but is never going to be fair, nourishing, safe, and protective for everyone. And so, while it is incredible to use and to teach spiritual and magical practices to secure the safety of ourselves and our clients and whoever else is able to reach and be impacted and implement this work, at the end of the day, we also really, wow, this episode is going all over the place, isn't it? At the end of the day, we also really need to keep in mind that fitting in with a broken system is not the end goal of spirituality. If that is the end goal of your practice, it's time to zoom out. You know, if this is just your personal practice, whatever, but if you are a leader, a teacher, if you are a coach, a mentor, if you are a healer of any kind, I think just, and this is, you know, this is a wake up call that I've had myself, right? I'm calling myself out on this as well, is just being like, do you know what? Like, it's no longer enough. Like, this system is so bad. And, you know, it sucks that it took me getting sick and physically not being able to work to realize. But sometimes, well, obviously I'm a third line. Sometimes we need to go through these personal initiations to be like, oh my goodness, you know, how many people are, and like, I'm lucky because I do work online and, you know, I'm in a reasonably, like I'm in a safe place. There are always people I can turn to for help if it got to the point where I couldn't bring in money and stuff, right? But how many people in the world are not in that kind of position, right? Who do get sick and it is genuinely the end of the world. So yes, that's my thoughts on that. Can't even remember what led me into that discussion. Oh yeah, your personal underworld, right? So what's present for you right now? What have you been ignoring? all of that. And, you know, I also put this in the email, but it really is just like, this is the initiation, this is the underworld moment that I have to take in order to complete this transition that I think has been going on for like a year or two. But moving from really what I stepped into my spiritual practice and really the point from which I found astrology and human design, which is more of the like manifestation and maybe like light and bright side of spirituality, and moving now into much more of like witchcraft, and, you know, being interested in spirits and being someone who worships gods and has like a personal practice you know, deity work, and that being something I'm much more interested in. Obviously, there is an underworld initiation that needs to happen as I do like fully make that transition. I don't even know what that exactly looks like right now, and for the first time, doesn't matter. It's just fun. Okay, well, fun. That's an interesting way of putting it. Okay, so we should probably start talking about the esoteric roots of human design before I speak for an hour on other assorted topics. All right. So firstly, I looked up the definition for esoteric just because I was curious, always curious. So esoteric in a dictionary definition means kind of like knowledge that is not known by everyone. So mysteries that are only available to initiates, right? People who have access, or it's like information that is only accessed by a select number of people, which is interesting because I guess we use esoteric today as a more kind of sweeping any magical practice and all of that. And it's also interesting to think of in terms of this information, because obviously with the internet today, everybody more or less does have access to information that in previous times, in ancient times, would have been esoteric. It would have been kept for initiates of the faith. Oh, sorry, I just bumped the table. It would have been kept for the priestesses, the priests. It would have been kept for people who are in some way like part of that practice, or who do that practice in their day-to-day life, right? But now it's like you can just Google and you can learn about these various things. Obviously, not all the information is available online. But yeah. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting. When we're talking about this, yeah, I think this is a really important conversation to have because, you know, okay, how do we say this? All right, so I am someone who I guess found human design from my interest in esoterica, right? It was like my interest in astrology, my interest in just magic and stuff led into human design. There are a lot of people, and you know, I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I think this is just a conversation we need to have and like needs to be brought to the table, right? There are a lot of people who find human design because it resides in a lot of like business focused communities, right? And like using your human design to build into your business or into like certain types of this. And a lot of people, I guess, try and separate the innate magic and esoterica that is like so deeply embedded into this practice from it. And it's like, okay, if that's something that scares you, or something that, you know, it's like if you liked the if you like the concept of human design, but the concept of, you know, other practices and magic and that sort of thing isn't so much for you, that's okay. But what can happen is that we never want it to get separated, right? We never want to lose fully the roots, right? The connection to magic and mystical practices and mysticism and divination that is so deeply embedded in human design, right? Even if we just think about the fact, like, let us not forget, this system came into practice because some dude who was really, really into spirituality felt a spark of divine light, took some drugs, went into a cave, meditated, and channeled this system, right? If that's not esoteric roots, you know, I don't know what is. All right, so just one other tiny little like tidbit before we go in. Please note, I am not of the Jewish faith. I am not Hindu. I am not a Chinese folk practitioner from thousands of years ago or today. I am going to do my very best to give correct information. Like I said, I've done a fair bit of research for this episode. However, if I do make a mistake, and you know, you are from one of these practices or you know about these practices, feel free to send me a message, send me an email, correct me. I love to be corrected. If it's pronunciation, can we just assume that is because my Australian accent, as much as I prefer like to think that I am cultured, more cultured than other Australian accenters, I'm not. And I find it difficult to pronounce sometimes the simplest words in even like the most classically European language, right? French? Who is she? It's beautiful. And like I've said, I'm going to be studying French this Australian summer. That's one of my little, I'm sick and I need rest, but I need to keep my brain going plans is to study French. But wow, even I think I found out I was even saying like, bonjour incorrectly. It was some like really, really simple word. Maybe it was the French word for bakery. It was something like that. And someone was like, what are you saying? I was like, I'm saying this. They're like, no, you're not. This is how you say it. Anyway, so if my pronunciation on anything is wrong, I'm sorry. I'm doing my best. Okay. So yeah, you can also, in addition to correcting me, you can also try and help me with pronunciation. However, people have tried that before, especially when it comes to the Jewish words. Yeah. Good luck to you. Okay. All right. So let's start with the, well, okay. Let's just start right with the way, well, people who are giving you like a kind of like rundown to human design are going to tell you, and rightly so, that it is based on a bunch of different practices, including the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, the I Ching, the chakra system to a certain extent, and Western astrology. And yeah, depending on who you're talking to, they'll say other various practices. And you know, I think a big one is quantum physics, and I always forget the word, but that word for where you can change your DNA based on your thoughts and environment. I should know this off by heart, but I forget this word every time I want to say it. So they're big ones too, especially when you get into like the gene keys route, off of like kind of like branching off of human design. So there are a bunch of things in there. But what we're going to do is we're going to actually dive into a few of these and learn about it. So let's start with the I Ching. So the I Ching, maybe it's the I Ching, again, pronunciation, I don't know. It's spelt I Ching. So I'm going to go with that. So the I Ching is an ancient, and when I say ancient, we are talking like around around 3,000 years ago, right? So around 1000 BC. It is an ancient Chinese method of divination. So there you go, esoterica, right? Like divination is embedded into this human design practice. What did I want to talk about in this? Yeah, divination to me is really, really fascinating across history because there are so many different methods. And what's really fascinating is that across different folk practices, and especially like, you know, in the last 2000 years, when even in the last like couple of hundred years, or, you know, 500, 600 years, whatever, when everyone was like, burn the witches, people were still practicing what might today we might like kind of lump under witchcraft, because they'd still be practicing divination, right? With some of my favorite methods being, I can't remember what it's called, but it's the one where you get the entrails. So you like cut the entrails out of like a chicken, for example, and then you read the entrails. And then this really happened, right? This is 100% something that's happening in, you know, a few different folk practices. I know it's common in quite a few European folk practices. I don't know much about elsewhere in the world. So divination was spread all throughout the world, and the I Ching was one that is, you know, part of Chinese practice. Okay, so basically what they would do, they would get yarrow stalks. they would arrange these yarrow stalks into bunches, and these would be set up. So you might have seen the 64 hexagrams, right? So each of these hexagrams. Okay, so wait, before I go any further, these 64 hexagrams of the I Ching that I'm talking about right now, they are what is like what the 64 gates of human design are based upon, right? That they are pulling from, that is embedded into this practice, right? So let's learn, let's know something about the roots of the culture, the practice, the belief that is embedded into what we're actually doing when we're talking about human design, right? And so yes, these would be arranged into bunches that would then form the 64 hexagrams. I couldn't figure out exactly what they're doing. Like, are they tying the hexagrams up? Are they just like, well, they must, because then what they do for the actual divination practice is they'd cast them. And so anything you cast, so I can't remember, wait, do I know the cleromancy? So cleromancy is the type of divination where you are casting something. So casting dice, casting seashells, you're essentially like throwing something, and then depending on what turns up, you're going to interpret it based on that. So they're casting these hexagrams, and they are interpreting messages from the ones that are cast. Now, the interpretations of the 64 hexagrams are obviously ancient. They have been deeply debated and discussed throughout history, and they are still discussed, and I'm sure, like, no doubt, are still debated. And, you know, they're also, and I think this is where a human design almost, like, well, it's almost like bringing it into the hands of, like, different types of people. I think it's, like, very, very deep in esoterica if you are, like, a Western practitioner, typically. Like, if you're not from a Chinese culture or practice or, you know, family or whatever. If you're typically, like, unless you're, like, super, super deep in esoterica, you're probably not, like, reading the I Ching. At least it was never something that turned up in my practice until human design, right? And this is where it's really interesting that it's almost like we still, even when we're looking at it from a human design perspective, even when we're looking at it from like the 64 gates, right, people are still discussing and debating, like, what does this one mean, what does this word mean, how do we interpret this, and people putting their own spins on it. And, you know, the debate between people being like, well, is it okay to put your own spin on it, can you interpret it, is this like modernizing it, or do people just want to be different, all of this stuff, right? And, you know, I don't know the correct answer there. I think there is something to be said for honoring the practice from which it came, and like honoring the culture's beliefs from which it came, and honoring the history from which it came, which is basically what I'm trying to do here. Again, if I am getting anything wrong and doing a terrible job at that, I deeply, deeply apologize. Right, okay, so even the, I think what's real, another little interesting fun fact, this is just all fun facts with Heather, right? Basically what this episode is. Another little fun fact was, what was I literally just about to say? Okay, yeah, so even the name of the book, so it was all written down into the Book of Zhu. Again, probably not pronouncing that right, but it's spelled Z-H-O-U. So even the translation for the title has been debated heavily. So the Book of Changes is obviously what you might have heard it referred to as, but people are still like really, really debating what changes, like what the best direct translation for changes would be in this context, like based on the symbol, like the little Chinese symbol. So some believe that the translation is to the word easy, the Book of Easy, and i.e. like this is easier divination than casting chicken bones. That's how they're potentially interpreting it, right? That is not me, obviously. But you know, makes sense. I can imagine casting chicken bones is quite a problem. Like, you have to find the chicken, you have to sacrifice the chicken, you have to, I mean, I'm guessing you eat the chicken, but I know that preparing bones, so I've not worked with animal bones in my personal practice, maybe eventually, but I know, like, preparing bones, obviously you need to, like, sterilize them and do all kinds of things and probably, like, give thanks to the chicken that gave its life, like, but here it's like you just, like, pick a bunch of yarrow, you organize the stalks, and then you just throw, right? Easy. Okay, but that's one potential one. Another potential translation is from Chinese folk etymology. And in this instance, it translates it, like, the little symbol into actually a sun and a moon. So again, like, changes a day and a night, you know, who knows? But again, it's not even decided upon. But yeah, so that's the I Ching. That's that connection there. So I definitely suggest, like, if you're curious about this, doing your own research into it, like, looking into it more, because it is really, really, really interesting. When I was studying the 64 gates in more depth, like, in my own studies, I read through each of the hexagrams and what they meant, and, like, learned the original, like, I Ching translations, like the marrying maiden, who is she, all of that. And I know you can get, my friend Abby, I remember when she was in Australia with me, actually, she bought a deck of cards that was, like, based on the I Ching, which would be a really, really incredible way to learn those original things too. Because I think, yeah, what can happen, especially if you are maybe learning human design now, when it is a practice that is being, which is incredible, right? It's being interpreted and used and applied by a lot of different practitioners, and obviously bringing in their own flavor and unique flair and all of that. But just having that, I guess, baseline understanding of this is where it came from originally. Like, this is what the first like hexagram originally meant. And so this is why we interpret it like that. And that's why some people interpret it like that, right? And again, the more knowledge you have, the more you are able to, it's like the more, okay, I feel like the more peoples and the more, yeah, different understandings and interpretations you have along with the original of a particular, like, gate in human design, you're going to be able to form your own interpretation based on your own life, your own experiences, and all of that as well. And it's just gonna, like, it's just gonna be more felt and experienced knowing. Okay, so we could talk about that forever, but we better move on to the next thing. So let's talk about the energy centers. So this one is really interesting. Obviously, the clearest connection here is to the chakra system. That again, from the research that I had done, is originating with the Hindu, like, Hindu practices and also Buddhist practices. What was really interesting is that I think it was, there was 4 or 5 main energy centers in the Buddhist framework, but then in the Hindu one there was the 6 plus 1 is the way they said it. So 6 kind of, like, of the self, and then plus 1 would be the crown, with that connection to God, or source, right? So yeah, this is really interesting. But there are also different practices or different, yeah, other, and again, it's like, is this true? Because, like, not a lot of it was written down, but, you know, you can sort of see if you look around into different, like, other ancient practices and beliefs and stuff. There are many different systems that have this, like, belief or, like, understanding. There are different energy centers or spiritual centers within the physical body. All right. Now, obviously, the biggest difference here are between the human design energy centers and the chakra system that's connected to we'll say Hinduism. Even though, yes, it also seems to originate with, like, Buddhists, or, like, be quite embedded into that belief system as well, is that we have 9 energies, like major energy centers in human design, and 7 in Hinduism, or like 6+1 as they phrased it. What I found really interesting when I was doing this research, actually, this I didn't know, is that, so you know how, like, if we're talking about, I guess, the more Western approach to chakras, or like how it's spoken about in this part of the world, there's typically like a color associated with each chakra system. That was actually the first, like, that's not from the original teachings that came into practice. It was like in the 1800s or something like that. The first person was like, yes, this one's red, this one's orange, this one's yellow. And I just found that so interesting because we all just like kind of take that for granted now. But it's all, then I was like, that's interesting because in human design, obviously the energy centers don't have a color associated with them. And that's almost always a question that my students have, like, do the different colors of the energy centers mean anything? And it's like, no, they only matters as to whether they're like colored in, defined or not. And so I wonder if the colors are just to do with, like, they were kind of brought in to help us understand the specific types of energy a bit better or something like that. Another thing I found interesting while researching this was Edgar Cayce. Okay, so you might have heard of Edgar Cayce. He was a mystic, I guess you could say. He got hypnotized, or he went into trance a bunch in the 1800s. Anyway, in one of his trances, or maybe multiples of his trances, he kind of like decided and brought forth this information that each of the spiritual energy centers in the body, right, so each of the chakras, connected to a line in the Lord's Prayer. So if you know, like, the classic Lord's Prayer, like, Our Father who art in heaven, blah 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 blah. Was that blasphemy to say blah 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 after that? I feel like I've just been smited. Amen. Yeah, like, each of those lines corresponding to that. So maybe I should find that, because this was interesting. One second, I'm just gonna... Okay, so I've just Googled it. All right, so the crown chakra... No, okay, let's start from the bottom. So the root chakra, bread, right? Give us this day our daily bread. Let's see if I can remember it. The second chakra, or the sacral chakra, temptation. Is it lead me not into temptation? I would need to say it from the start to get it right. The third chakra, so the solar plexus, connected to debt, the word debt in the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us, is that trespasses? I'm gonna guess that's trespasses. But yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the solar plexus being like in this like 7 chakra system about, I guess, your personal power and stuff. 4, so heart, evil. Maybe it's deliver us from evil, something like that. The 5th, so that's the throat, being connected to the word will in the prayer. The Ajna, being connected to the word name, hallowed be thy name. Oh, it's going the other way. Okay. Okay, because the crown is father. Again, you just like getting to hear my brain work in real time. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. That's the Ajna. Thy will be done. That's the throat. Okay, anyway, we don't need to figure it out right now. If you are interested, feel free to Google that yourself. So, yeah. So then what has happened? What has happened is, the law or the teaching in human design is that because humans have expanded, or what's the word, like, evolved to a certain extent, we have expanded the number of like major energy centers. But it's also really interesting because we have so many minor chakras too, like when you get into other beliefs. So I want to say this is more the like Taoism. I could be so wrong. It's whatever they're using in acupuncture and stuff like that, because, and like kinesiology too, because both my current kinesiologist and my previous kinesiologist, they're like, yeah, you have like literally hundreds of little like minor chakras as well. But anyway, so these major ones have evolved into being nine centered beings. And then of course, part of the 2027 vision for humanity is that we will evolve once again and turn into 11 centered beings. Very, very, very interesting. I think personally, just a tiny little hot take on 2027, stop focusing on 2027 and focus on what you can do right now, right? 2027 magically coming into being does not mean that the entire world will change. Well, it might, maybe, I don't know, the entire world is changing right now. But also, just focus on yourself right now, right? Nobody's coming to save us. Nobody's coming to destroy us. Let's just do what we gotta do. And yeah, 2027 is just a date. It's just a year. The transition, whatever transition, if we are merging into these magical 11-centered beings, it will be over time. Hey, maybe we're mating with these aliens that the government has just admitted exist, right? And that's how we turn into 11-centered beings. I'm just having fun. Okay, don't take it so seriously. All right, so that's that. We better keep moving because I want to talk about the Tree of Life. So this is where, back to our fun fact about the Jewish death ritual, the Kabbalistic death ritual. Okay, so we are now going to talk about, okay, so a lot of people know in human design, and this is great, that the 36 channels are what is connected to the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. But this becomes confusing when you actually look at the Tree of Life, and I'll talk about like what is the Kabbalah in a second. Again, I know I'm pronouncing that wrong. If you are Jewish, I'm so, so sorry. I'm not going to try and pronounce hummus the proper way. In Australia, it's so funny. Okay, I'm just going to interrupt us quickly to say a tiny little story. But you know, I'm just laughing, remembering. So you guys know my really, really good friend, Vanessa. She's Italian. She's the best. I stayed with her family in Italy earlier this year. We met in Indonesia, all the stuff. But I was like hanging out with her and a Spanish guy in Indonesia. And we went out for Israeli food, like Middle Eastern food. And, you know, the Australian way to say hummus is hummus. Like that's how it's spelt. On all of our hummus packaging, it's like H-U-M-M-U-S. And oh my goodness, did they laugh? And hearing them, like with their beautiful Italian Spanish accents, saying hummus the Australian way, I died. Anyway, so yeah, pronunciation of Middle Eastern words, no. Okay. So, yes, you're going, anyway, back on track. So you're going to look at this Tree of Life and you're going to say, but there is not 36, right? Because what it is it's 10 centers, so 10 energy centers. It looks quite similar to a human design body graph in that you have the centers, or like the circles, which are connected by, so you have 10 centers connected by 22 channels, like 22 flows of energy, 22 lines of energy, that move between these centers and like kind of like flow the energy between them. And so even if you add 10 plus 22, it's 32, it's not 36. And obviously there are 10 centers in the Tree of Life, etc. So it's not a direct match, right? It's not like the I Ching connection where you can look at gate one connects to I Ching, hexagram one, etc. like that. It's not like that. It's a bit of not exactly a looser connection, but there is a strong resonance. But it's not like a direct, like this for that. It's not like a direct exchange. Okay. So that's really important to know. All right. So yeah, the deep importance that like Ra-Uruhu is essentially like what he said that is coming from the Tree of Life is like the deep meaning and importance put on the channels connecting to the centers, right? That we're not just putting our importance and our resonance into the centers themselves, but also the journey between them, the energy that's flowing between them, the steps, the information that moves between each of the centers in the Tree of Life. Now, I am not an expert in Kabbalah. It's something that I actually might put on my list to study a bit deeper over this Australian summer while I'm living in my parents' beach house. Yeah, and then I can maybe do an update episode. So I guess having that will be good motivation to do that. But at the moment, I'm not an expert. That importance put on the meaning of the channels, that's what Ra really, really echoed into this, again, very, very esoteric system of human design, right? Kabbalah is the most, I guess, the most famous, the most well-known form of Jewish mysticism. And it's probably the most like widespread form of Jewish mysticism as well. this is an esoteric practice in that, I guess, like literal sense. In that, okay, so this is what I've learned. Kabbalah is said to be like information, practice, teachings, and studies handed down from, it's said, again, this is what a lot of practitioners say. I don't know if this is true, but that the teaching stem from the revelation to Moses at Mount Sinai in the 13th century BC. So a long time ago, very, very, very ancient. It is believed to have been practiced openly in ancient Israel. It is said to have had like over a million followers in ancient Israel throughout this time. But eventually, due to foreign invaders and various political and religious takedowns and all of that stuff, it had to go underground at some point and become hidden knowledge. So throughout this time, it would not have been written down. It would have, and maybe it was never written down until the last like few hundred years or whatever. it would genuinely have just been taught like father to son or whatever it is, right? Handed down in families, whether that be literal families or just initiates to this, again, very, very, very esoteric belief system, right? Basically they thought that this information had to become hidden just in case the knowledge fell into the wrong hands. And I think that's really, really interesting, because obviously something that we reflect on, well, that I reflect on and a lot of people think about in religion, is that the roots of religion, like most religions, I think I was talking about this last week actually, that like most religions have a beautiful like hint of truth or like deep like meaning and heart within them. It's just when those teachings get into and interpreted by the wrong people who do not have unconditional love at their heart, and it's more about control or power or domination or whatever they're bringing into this practice, that's when the religion gets sort of twisted, right? So it's like they sort of understood that, and so they did what they had to do to protect these teachings from becoming well known, right? So it is a system that you have to learn in stages, from what I understand, right? So it's believed, and it is probably true, that like we, even if we have like books on this system, even if we're Googling it madly, right, that is still only having access to a very, very small percentage of the full teachings. You would have to go through the full initiation process or whatever it is, and learn it in what seem to be four stages. I don't know if they're like one after the other or they're just four different parts of studying and embodying and practicing Kabbalistic teachings, right? Yeah, you would have to do that to actually learn beyond almost what is just on the surface, right? So even if we can study this Tree of Life and what each energy center represents in that, and like what the channels flowing between it and these like different beautiful deep teachings, right, have to teach us, it's still only just a fragment of the full depth and breadth of what is available in Kabbalah. Okay, so that's that. Hopefully I will study it more and learn more. Right, and so obviously then you also have astrology. So this is something that I will not talk about deeply because obviously astrology is something I've spoken about a lot before. But Western astrology and its like impact in human design, it's astrology too. It's like this is a deeply, deeply esoteric practice. Well, kind of. I mean, astrology, if you go back thousands and thousands of years, it would have been, it was much more like prediction focused. Honestly, it was like, we need to know like when is the right time to do this, to impale the king, to I don't think that's the right word, getting tired now, to plant our garden, right? Like it was a little bit different to how we use it today. Today, because we go to the supermarket and we're not so in tune with like at what point in the year we plant our corn in order for the best harvest, right? Unless we're a farmer or a homesteader. We're much more focused on the psychological components of astrology, right? And so I think this is, which is probably going to be a part of astrology that's really only coming into, you know, really the last, like, I guess, 300-ish years. But especially the last 100 years or so, astrology has taken on that more psychological approach. So there's that. But it is still a very, very mystical, magical teaching. We cannot separate that. You know, you're not just, like, walking down the street and being like, oh, you know, Uranus is doing this and therefore I feel this, right? It's still not that normalized. Like people are still like, oh, that's weird. And so just remembering that so the purpose of this episode was really for us to never forget this, like never forget where this practice, like the roots that it has it in, to hopefully educate people who, you know, those of us who don't have a deep awareness of some of these practices. And hopefully, I mean, this is just a starting point, like I said, hopefully to inspire you to research this some more, like, you know, to study this some more. Okay, so that's everything. I am sending you guys lots of love. You can come follow me on Instagram. It is at Relentless Alignment. I love feeling your presence there. What's been really, really nice is that obviously since I guess came back from my little podcast hiatus, I have been much more focused on the witchy side of things, the mystical side of things. And, you know, maybe a lot of my past audience was maybe not so much into that. And that is fine. But I've really started to notice, A, those people who are much more into the magical, mystical thing are like talking, you know, coming out of the woodwork and being like, yeah, this is cool. Like, keep talking about this, which is great. Please let me know. But then also like new people are finding the podcast now who are much more interested in the witchy side of things, which is so good to see because that is really where I see this podcast going. Talking about boring stuff is boring. And that is not to say that stuff I used to talk about is boring. It's just boring to me now. All right. Anyway, so I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to call it. I might even like put this episode out early. My impatience is debilitating sometimes. So if you're listening to this on Tuesday evening when I just recorded and hit publish, hello. If you're listening to this later, also hello. Right, I've been blabbering on for too long. I'm going to leave it there. Sending you love. Farewell.